Good afternoon and welcome to the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program, demonstrating the impact of supportive housing. To begin, we will go over a few logistics for the webinar. All participant lines will be muted during today's webinar. To participate in a polling question, please exit out of full screen mode. To use the chat box on your screen to ask a question or leave a comment. And please complete the evaluation in the pop-up box after the webinar to help us continue to improve your experience. I will now turn the webinar over to Melanie Brown.
Thank you, Christina. Good afternoon or good morning, everyone. I'm Melanie Brown with the CMS. I'm a technical director with the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program, which is within the Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services. The purpose of today's webinar, we hope that participants will learn the benefits and advantages of measuring outcomes to assess the impact of supportive housing. We also hope that you'll become more familiar with measures that have been used to assess the impact of supportive housing, that you'll understand some of the considerations that are associated with measuring supportive housing outcomes, and that you'll learn from the experience of two state Medicaid directors that have been involved in this type of work. So we're going to start today off with a polling question. We'd like to get a sense of who's joining us today. If you could take a couple of minutes to respond to the polling question, it is who is joining us on the webinar today. And we're looking for your organizational affiliation. Please indicate whether or not you are from a state Medicaid agency, a state housing agency, another state agency, services, or a state agency that serves a particular population, a regional or local housing organization, a regional or local support or service provider, managed care organization, an advocacy organization, or another type of organization. And I think we'll give another 30 seconds or so for people to respond. Looks like things are slowing down. If you haven't already provided a response, please do so. Okay, we're going to go ahead and close the poll. Okay, and it looks like the majority of our participants today represent advocacy organizations. Followed by other state agencies, as well as state Medicaid agencies and state housing agencies. So welcome to you all. We hope that you'll find the content that we have for you helpful. So the agenda for today's webinar, we're starting with a welcome and a bit of background about the Innovation Accelerator Program. We'll then present a framework for demonstrating the impact of supportive housing, followed by the opportunity to hear directly from states who've used this framework or a work that is similar to this. We'll then talk about some frequently used outcome measures to measure the impact of supportive housing, again, followed by the opportunity to hear directly from states. And then we'll have some time for question and answers, followed by closing remarks and an evaluation. So to begin with, Medicaid IAP, or the Innovation Accelerator Program, is a Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation funded program that's led by the Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services. The overall goal for IAP is to increase the number of states that are moving towards delivery system reform. IAP is not a grant program. Participating states receive targeted technical support. So the State Medicaid Housing Agency Partnership Track is one of our technical support initiatives that falls under the umbrella of the IAP priority area called Community Integration Through Long-Term Services and Supports. Our goals include increasing state adoption of individual tenancy sustaining services to assist Medicaid beneficiaries, facilitating partnerships with housing agencies, and increasing state adoption of strategies that tie together quality, costs, and outcomes in support of community-based long-term services and support programs. So consistent with statute, CMS does not provide federal financial participation for room and board in home and community-based services. The focus of the technical support that states received tends to revolve around peer-to-peer learning opportunities, as well as helping states to identify goals and resources that can assist them and creating and implementing action plans. So we're currently providing technical support to our third cohort of states. We've provided technical support to a total of 19 states since 2015, and the graphic on the screen highlights the states that we've been able to work with. Some of the key accomplishments of the State Medicaid and Housing Agency Partnerships track include establishing Medicaid and housing cross-agency partnerships, aligning existing housing and healthcare policies, developing or expanding data matching to target resources, examine costs and measure the impact of supportive housing, and developing policies and mechanisms to increase supportive housing and other community living opportunities. I'm now going to turn it over to Kathy Moses, Associate Director with the Associate Director of Policy with the Center for Healthcare Strategies, and she's going to talk about the framework for demonstrating the impact of supportive housing.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Melanie. This is Kathy Moses, and I just want to introduce myself. I have worked with the Innovation Accelerator Program since its inception. Our organization has served as coach to the states for all three cohorts, and I'm really excited to be here today to talk about demonstrating the impact of supportive housing and what are some of the things we need to do to get started. So first off, what are the benefits? Why do we measure, or what various reasons why we would measure the impact of supportive housing? And before I jump in here, I just want to underscore the results of the survey that this particular type of work, you know, is not singly housed in Medicaid or the housing agency. It really is a partnership, and because of that, everyone owns a piece but doesn't own all of it, and that's why the partnership is so valuable. And so keeping that in the back of our minds, that's an important piece of why we're measuring and keeping in mind who we're trying to communicate with in terms of our outcome measures. And that's really the first bullet here, that we're measuring the impact of supportive housing across different silos, different geographies, different populations, and need to have foresight into what it is we'll want to communicate so that we are collecting it. In some states, in some places, it is important to be able to determine or demonstrate the effectiveness of the supportive housing services. In other states, it may be something else. It may be more about costs. These next two bullets are about costs, both looking at individuals who are stably housed versus those who are unhoused, and then in addition to the individual level or groups of individuals, just looking across the healthcare system as a whole and where are the costs being reduced or increased given these services. Last but not least, we're also interested in looking at how we can increase community integration through supportive housing. Again, recalling that it is a task of many and successful when everyone is working together, knowing that this we're bringing things closer together for the community as a community is important as well. And so in this next slide,
Kathy, I'm sorry, this is Melanie. We're getting some chats that are saying that folks are still on the cover, still on the title page for the the slides. Christina, do you know if we're having any issues, technical issues?
I am on slide number 14 right now with the graphic with the weight and the scale. Can we have a participant confirm if they are
seeing? Somebody said they're seeing, the participants are helping. Somebody said they're seeing the current slides now. Okay. Sorry for the interruption.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
No problem.
They're not on the cover page. They can see the slides. Okay. And if you're having difficulties with the audio can broadcast through the webinar, through your computer if you have that capability, or you can call in to the phone number and we can post that. Christina, if you can post that phone number back on the chat just in case anybody needs that again. Thank you, Kathy.
Sure. Great. Glad we have everyone following along. And so when we think about the impact of supportive housing, we think about increasing and decreasing different things. Hopefully, with the services that are being provided, there's an increase to cost savings, an increase to overall collaboration across the health system. And for individuals, an increase in quality of life and self-sufficiency. And on the other side of the scale, we're hoping to detect a decrease in shelter usage, jail recidivism, and misuse of health systems. In terms of what we need to measure, one of the first questions a state needs to ask themselves, or a group of parties that come together as partners need to ask themselves, is who is the target population? And this is not necessarily always an easy question. It may be that there is a governor's level mandate or a legislative interest in a particular group or population, and that's where the initial traction takes place. I keep making sure my slides are correct here. With that, it's important that we know kind of what the drivers are. What are we trying to achieve? It could be that there's a strong interest in reducing emergency department visits or inpatient hospital stays. The main driver could be improving health outcomes or stability for tenants. More than likely, it's more than one of these, but I think it's important to kind of think about where's the charge coming from and what needs to be measured so that we can then do the best job of picking indicators for these goals. The next thing that needs to happen is identifying data sources. And so on this next slide, it's just a couple of examples of data sources. Of course, there's the Medicaid MMIS, Management Information System, the Homeless Management Information System, but there's also clinics and ED data sources, as well as behavioral health, substance abuse, jails, courts, transportation, so a variety of sources generally it's the more the merrier, but oftentimes we can't let the perfect get in the way of good and getting all of these data sources together in one under one roof and most importantly thinking about it as an iterative process in order to start to paint a really good picture of the population we're trying to work with. Talking about the target population a little bit more here, thinking back to what is our driver? What is really helping us move this forward? Is it, as I was saying earlier, a governor's or a Medicaid or a housing initiative? Is there a legislative requirement to focus on a certain group of individuals that makes it the logical place to start? A lot of times there are high-cost users who are targeted, but it can also be from the medical complexity, beneficiaries who have really complex needs, or individuals with high homelessness recidivism, those who just keep cycling in and out and spending a long time in homelessness, who may be the initial target population. And again, it's not limited to one. It could be many. But important to think about who are we targeting so that we can think about providing access to the right data. So the next thing under ensuring access to the data, one of the most important steps and probably timely steps is time-consuming steps is developing data sharing and data use agreements. I think we'll hear from the states here on the line today that starting early is important to make sure that we get plenty of time. I am so sorry. Here we go. We have plenty of time. So that we have plenty of time to finalize agreements and move forward with them. Another tip really is leveraging existing opportunities. Should there be, again, something that's been started, maybe some data sharing with health plans or data sharing, with a small piece of the homeless information system, management information system, that could also be a place to start and build on that. But it is very important to develop those relationships and get everyone pointed in the same direction, because it does take time and have multiple levels usually of approval. And also one other note, if including substance use data, it is an additional consideration in terms of the privacy laws around that and making sure that that is considered in advance as well. Okay, next slide. As far as methodology, again, it's important to think about what we're trying to accomplish and what we want to be able to evaluate or study in terms of these outcome measures. So understanding if, based on the size of the beneficiaries that we're looking to cover, the target population, if we need a sample size, if there's a certain methodology, sampling methodology that we want to look at, to accomplish our goals. There are a couple of different types of, and if you probably know these different types of studies, a pre-post test, which can be helpful in terms of seeing changes in the target population, looking at controls and comparison groups. Sometimes a randomized control trial is merited. That and the longitudinal studies are obviously longer and take more money and more time to accomplish. But in some cases, that is what is needed. And so being mindful of who you're speaking to with your study or evaluation is also a key piece in considering these study methodologies. And so the next slide is my opportunity to turn this over for a few minutes to Judy Moore Peterson, who is the Director of Medicaid in the state of Hawaii, and Kate McAvoy, who is the Medicaid Director in Connecticut. Both very personally and actively participated in IAP in Cohort 1 with their states. And they each have very different stories. Judy, I think, is one of soup to nuts, under their time with IAP, starting from meeting the partners at the table and working with them to develop some services and a program. And with Kate in Connecticut, they came to the table as partners already and had been working together and built upon some of those experiences and data sharing knowledge. And so I think they offer a really nice complementary perspective on how states come together and partner within the state, come together and partner on housing services. So I think I'm going to turn it over first to Judy, and then Judy, if you don't mind passing the mic to Kate when you're done, then we'll pause and take some questions.
Thank you, Kathy. I'm happy to do that. I really appreciate it. Appreciate the opportunity to share some of our perspectives from Hawaii and from the Medicaid director getting things started. Kate and I were in the beginning, the first cohort, and very appreciative of that opportunity to participate We learned a lot. There was a lot of great targeted technical assistance, and I think without that, we would have. I don't think that we would have gotten it off the ground. I appreciate the perspectives of what it sort of takes to get started. I know that you started off by outlining what it takes to get started on the measuring of the benefits and how important. But I'm just going to outline a couple of other things that I think are really key to getting things together, and use examples from our state in Hawaii. First of all, in thinking about it, even before you start thinking about your sort of like your tactical goals that you're trying to accomplish, really it's important to think about what the overarching goal is trying to achieve. You need that, and you need that agreement amongst your partners, because we're bringing together, at least in Hawaii, we're bringing together people who normally we work in completely different areas. We have our own sets of acronyms, our own sets of languages and authorities and what we can do and not do, and sometimes we're using the same words, but we mean completely different things, like what permanent supportive housing means in Medicaid is actually not paying for permanent housing, which comes as a surprise to housing people. And so I think having an understanding of what your overarching goal is that you're trying to achieve is really important, so that as you're dealing with your various frustrations or trying to figure out what are they saying, you can point to, oh, this is the direction we're going, this is why we're doing this, et cetera. So in Hawaii, we have the highest per capita homeless population in the country. And so addressing the homelessness is a very key governor priority, legislative priority, and each of our agencies' priority. When the opportunity came up to take a look at different ways of providing or building on, expanding on these community integration services, we really took that up as a way in which to address that strong connection between health and housing. I think we first wanted to target working with the chronic homeless population, because they're the ones who are using the healthcare services more than other populations. And so in the thinking about that target population, it also makes a difference when you're thinking about what kind of costs you're going to incur, or that concept of return on investment. The more acute, the more people have really complex health needs, then the more cost savings you're likely to achieve by the reduction of the use of acute healthcare services like hospitalizations or emergency room use. But the more that you target a population that is perhaps at risk of homelessness, or at risk of, or does not have a severe of health needs, then that you're not going to see the same kind of savings, and in fact, you may actually see an increase in some of your costs. So, in bringing together all these disparate partners, as was mentioned before, it takes a lot of work to do that. So having a clear goal that you're setting your sights on, being really clear about what your target population is, being developing those relationships, that always is key, building up those trust relationships. Even before I can start working on a data share agreement with someone, it goes a lot better, and it works a lot better if we've been working together, if we've already been working on establishing those shared relationships, shared literacy about the terms, et cetera, and that we have a shared vision and goals of where we're trying to go. I think the couple other areas that I would want to focus on and emphasize is that in the health outcomes area, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in a little bit, but in that particular area, it actually isn't a decrease in health utilization. Our expectation in working on this is actually that we would see a decrease in the use or/misuse of emergency room use, and indeed that is indeed what we've started to see, and in a decrease in the use of inpatient care. But we would also expect to see an increase in primary care, in preventive care, in mental health care, and substance use disorder types of treatment. Hopefully less of the crisis and more of that primary care and behavioral health recovery services. So you really do need to bring all these folks together. I know we were talking about the housing folks and Medicaid, and that is certainly an area that needs a lot of focus, as well as with the social service agencies that are working with the homeless population. But the other area, at least for us in our Medicaid program, is to work with our sister agencies on who provide the behavioral health services and the behavioral health policy areas.
And Judy, maybe you can share more about that a little bit later, and maybe we can have Kate talk a little bit about the getting started piece.
Then
we'll go to some questions from the audience.
Thank you. There are huge data challenges, and Kate, I know, can talk a lot about that. So, Kate, what are your thoughts?
Great. Thank you, Judy, and as are you. I'm very privileged to participate this afternoon. I want to echo the praise for the IAP. It has incredible utility for us, I think, for states at any stage of development in this type of work, which is complex and requires a lot of synthesis of different policy aspects, authority, funding. The protected space that you have with the IAP, I think, is a real gift for giving you that opportunity to really dig in. I resonated so much with the themes that Judy sounded, particularly starting with the context piece. For us, we were able to really fit in with our existing health reform agenda, our efforts around elimination of homelessness, and also justice reform. So being informed by how those strands all relate, very, very important. Also totally hear and resonate with what JD said around shared literacy and trust basis. So much leaps off that, and IEP was remarkably facilitative of that, I think, for all of us who have participated. Just building on what Judy said, from the standpoint of where we thought it was useful to start at the threshold, inventorying existing interventions and sources of data, as Judy began to talk about, are useful. In Connecticut, we had an already existing state-funded portfolio of supportive housing that had many years of experience and some data associated with it. We also had longitudinal data from our Money Follows the Person initiative. We have a Housing Plus Services Money Follows the Person initiative that marries up Medicaid, home and community-based services with housing vouchers. So we were able to really identify and build from that, as well as two privately funded pilots. We essentially were starting in the strong position of having proved out a hypothesis at the outset that this proposition that housing, stabilized housing, improves the capacity of people with complex needs to engage in their health care, to improve outcomes, and to improve their life satisfaction and care experience. So I think looking at what you already have in place, even if it's on a modest scale, very important. And then an absolutely essential next step, which was flagged just a moment ago, was that data matching. We were able to match our fully integrated Medicaid claims data set with our fully statewide HMIS data set. I think the benefit of my learning with this was that you don't know what that data is going to show you, and it is revelatory. So disabusing ourselves of preconceptions of what of who might emerge in the match, I think, is very useful. And then the final thing I'll say, because I know we're definitely looking to hear your questions, is we had, from the inception point with this project, deliberately framed it as transcending specific budget lenses. This was not simply about Medicaid impact and potential savings or housing impact and savings. We purposely braided our approach in terms of making the case for Medicaid authority and funding in the state budget. We urged our budget folks to lift themselves out of their specific orientation, and really it is about braiding resources, Medicaid, and those housing vouchers. So I think that's a very useful thing to think about at the conception point so that you're prepared to kind of overcome some of these silos that have impaired us historically. So let me turn it back to Melanie. I think she's going to be moderating the question period.
Thank you, Kate and Judy, for that very helpful information. And we're going to check the chat box to see what questions we have. And I'm going to start from the bottom just because it's easier. So the first question I see here, I noticed that IEP has not worked with any states in the Southeast through this program. Is there an effort to work with one or more states in this area to develop capacity to participate in this cohort? So I'll go ahead and take that question. So typically, all states are invited to apply to participate in our IEP cohorts under the community integration through long-term services and support. So the level of geographic diversity is largely dependent on states that apply to participate. And I believe with the exception of perhaps the first cohort where we had over 25 states that apply, most states that apply for support are invited to join the track. The only exceptions might be if the type of technical support that the state needs is not a good fit for the type of technical support that we could provide. So that said, if you have a state that's interested, please be checking our Medicaid.gov updates. Typically, that's how new track or technical support initiatives through IEP are announced. Okay. I'm going to skip over the questions that are around the slide issues. I'm hoping those have been addressed. I am interested on any specific thoughts on addressing the research gaps identified by the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine 2018 report, Permanent Supportive Housing, evaluating the evidence for improving health outcomes among people experiencing chronic homelessness. So I don't know if there's a specific question there. I'll invite any of our panelists if you have any thoughts that you want to, off the top of your head, respond to there. But it may be helpful for the person that posed that question. If you have a specific question that you're looking to related to our content, to go ahead and enter that in the chat box. But let me just pause a moment to see if anyone, Melanie, Kathy, Judy, Kate, anything that you'd like to say to, in response to that?
Well, this is Kate. I'll just offer briefly that we do really have challenges with capturing the kind of entirety of experience for people who are not stably housed, and I think we all have a lot of humility around this, particularly around the touch points with healthcare. In fact, we may see people who are severely underutilizing healthcare other than emergency room visits. So I think there are definitely some built-in challenges there. There's definitely, I know in many states, not the luxury of having an existing state-funded supportive housing portfolio from which you can draw lessons and from which data has emerged.
But I would say there are some of us states that now have longitudinal data. As I remarked, you know, there are money follows the person data, our state funded portfolio, also the private pilots that we have done, really are a source of information, and we'd love you to be able to analogize to our experience. I think that is now getting a bit more solidified as states are having more experience.
Thanks, Kate. Anyone else? And I'm not seeing. Okay.
There was a question about braided funding for the state. Let's see. How did Connecticut or Hawaii get braided funding into their budget?
This is Kate. I certainly use the generous term of braiding. It's not precisely braiding in the standpoint of creating a pool, a flexible pool from which dollars can be elastically applied. What we did do is we essentially framed this as a proposal for our budget office to cover supportive housing services under Medicaid that would necessarily involve both Medicaid services and new housing vouchers. We actually had distinct analysts in our budget office who handled each of those different domains of work, and we really got them on deck at an early juncture point to say, we'd like to make sure that this is proposed in concert. We framed out the return on investment, cognizant of both of those areas of spend, and the governor's proposal in our budget cross-referenced the two items across departments in order to develop, to illustrate the interrelationship of it. So the legislature was asked really to appropriate funds on that basis, not simply in a silo of one department's budget.
Great. Thanks, Kate. And it looks like we're just about out of time for questions for this section. We will have additional time for questions after the next section. And I'm going to turn it over to Melanie Starnes, who is our senior director responsible for from IBM Watson Health, responsible for our state Medicaid and housing agency partnerships track. And she's going to talk about outcome measures that are frequently used to demonstrate the impact of supportive housing.
Well, hello, everybody. Thank you for all your questions in the chat box. Hopefully we'll get them all answered. This section of the webinar is going to provide some of the specific kind of measures that states and localities have used. So it's not necessarily a state and everybody's done it statewide. And some of it may be cities, some may be counties, some may be a region and state. But if you are looking to do this kind of work, I think it's valuable to see a range of different types of measures that folks have used over the years to assess and demonstrate the impact that supportive housing has had on a variety of different pieces. So we have sort of four areas that we're looking at here, including measures around healthcare utilization, around homelessness, because that is a common target population. Then a couple of things on tenancy, and then around law enforcement and criminal justice. That's one of the areas. And what you're looking for here is, if you look at this measure, what kind of expected change, what kind of change would you expect to see due to the use of supportive housing? Okay. So the first set, we have several around healthcare utilization. The first one that's a really common measure is looking at emergency department visits. And with supportive housing usage, then you would expect to see a reduction in the number of visits, and then, of course, the cost for visits as well. You'd also, one of the other things we look at is hospital inpatient admissions. And, again, with supportive housing, people in supportive housing more stable, we typically would expect to see a reduction in the number and cost of hospitalizations, less intense if they do need it. And then inpatient hospital stays. So you've got admissions, and then you've got the length of stay that you're measuring and the cost of that, and we would expect to see a change, a reduction in the length of stays and the cost associated with that. Also looking around behavioral health, so looking at psychiatric inpatient hospital stays, their frequency, and the duration. So we would expect to see a reduction in the use of mental health crisis services for folks who are using supportive housing. We would expect to see a reduction in psychiatric inpatient hospitalizations and healthcare costs, associated healthcare costs. We would expect to see improvement in mental health outcomes, and there's a number of states that have looked at different things than that. And then also a reduction in the duration of the psychiatric hospital stays. So not saying it prevents it entirely, but maybe those stays are shortened. Another measure in healthcare utilization costs is looking at outpatient mental health service utilization. And this is one of those interesting ones that while you may see a reduction, the second bullet there on the right, you may see a reduction in overall mental health service costs. You may actually see an increase initially in the use of outpatient mental health services because people, as they start to shift from using crisis services and using emergency room, emergency department services, they switch to outpatient and more appropriate services because everything, other things in their life are stable. You may actually see an increase in outpatient mental health services. And that's an important thing to mention, in particularly in state government, when you're saying if we do the supportive housing, we can see some shifts and some better outcomes and perhaps some cost savings. And then if you have an increase in a particular area, it's important to make sure that leadership is aware of that possibility. And typically the research indicates that over the course of 1 to 2 years, those costs kind of level out as everything gets stable and the shifts are finalized. Okay. And finally, in healthcare utilization, looked at measures using states look at substance use disorder, the use of detoxification services. They would expect to see a reduction in the use of detox services and a reduction in healthcare costs for detox services and interventions, not indicating that you cannot have substance use disorders or use substances in supportive housing, but they have found that when people are in supportive housing, they need less of these services. And then use of emergency medical services expect to see a reduction in the use and the cost of those services for people who are in supportive housing. Okay. So a couple of measures around homelessness. You might obviously expect the number of people experiencing homelessness to have a reduction. If people are housed and they're not on the streets, that's a kind of a straightforward one there. The length of time people remain homeless, as they're obviously in supportive housing, then that would go down as well. And then emergency shelter use, you'd expect to see a reduction in housing costs. Emergency shelters can be very expensive to run. And then a decrease in the number of days of shelter use, obviously, when folks are in supportive housing. A couple of measures around tenancy. And this just helps to see that not everything is necessarily about healthcare utilization. So one of the measures some states have used was looking at the tenure in supportive housing. How long have they been in supportive housing? And they're seeing a correlation between the length of time they're in supportive housing and then a decrease in healthcare costs with the increase in the time that they're in housing. And also, the longer they're in housing, they are seeing a reduction in the rate of return to homelessness. So the longer they're in housing, the further away from homelessness they folks tend to get. And then another interesting one that's kind of off the beaten path is some localities looked at a change in tenants' income. And they actually found that to be quite useful measure and found that there was a positive correlation between the increased income and housing retention. So something a little different to measure and that the states found pretty useful. Okay, then when you look at law enforcement and criminal justice, some states looked at arrest rates for those in supportive housing compared to those who were not. And they found that there was a decreased rate of arrest amongst those in supportive housing and a decrease then in law enforcement costs for those related to those in supportive housing. So those are outside of the healthcare arena for sure. And then when we looked even further, Facebook even further and looked at the cost of incarceration and jail services for those going to in supportive housing compared to non-house individuals. And a couple of measures, things that they found was a reduction in incarcerated incarceration-related health care costs. Of course, people are not in prisons and jails. The health care costs are down. And then another big impact was the reduction in community reentry housing location costs. And those of you working in that arena know that that can be it's quite a challenge and a long and lengthy and somewhat extensive process to help prisoners find housing and folks who are released move back into the community. So to illustrate what a couple of states have done with some of these types of measures is we've got a couple ones here. In Massachusetts, in 2017, they did this study of people experiencing chronic homelessness, and they found that for every dollar they spent on supportive housing and case management services, it translated into as much as $2.43 in savings due to reductions in other types of health care services use. That's a pretty good rate of return on that, rate of ROI. And then in Connecticut, even more recently, in 2018, Connecticut reported that overnight hospitalization, so that was one of the measures we looked at, among Medicaid beneficiaries dropped from 8.5 incidences in the 12-month period before they were in supportive housing to just 2.7 incidences in the 12 months after they were in supportive housing. So pretty significant decrease. And also that emergency department visits also decreased from 13 the year before housing to just 5, so a two-thirds decrease in the 12 months after housing. So those are some very specific measures for you. And Kate, we're just for this last slide here talks about work that happened in your state. And so we're going to turn back to Kate and Judy now. I will tell you we're going to move back to this slide, and we'll be on this slide for a little bit so you're not missing anything. There's no other slides that should be popping up for you. But Kate and Judy, we're going to start back with you and hear back from you. The last slide depicts work that was done by your state team. What else can you share with us about what Connecticut's been doing and the impact that you've seen in your state from supportive housing?
Well, thank you very much. I think that was an extraordinarily helpful inventory of some important focus areas and measurement for all states. Certainly those were very high on our radar screen in terms of the original framework. What I will say is, leaping off that last slide, I want to credit the Corporation for Supportive Housing and the Connecticut Coalition Down Homelessness for really approaching our department, the Medicaid agency, not only around data matching, but on partnering to examine the results of what became two pilots, which were designed to illustrate impact from supportive housing interventions. Part of the staging of those pilots, which one of which was funded by the Social Innovation Fund, was really to develop a measure framework for assessing impact. And so many of the features of what you discussed, Melanie, really figured prominently there. This slide capsules only two indicators related to acute care. But I just want to reinforce what you said, and that is that taking an expansive view of this is really important, not only with the reduction of the acute costs related to hospital, but in Connecticut, we have seen this set of interventions intercepting a cycle that we were often experiencing where individuals with complex needs went into the hospital via the emergency room, were discharged to skilled nursing facilities, and then discharged because of an inability to meet level of care requirements for Medicaid back to unstable housing or homelessness. So the experience with skilled nursing facility care is also something I think was very important for us to pay attention to. Correspondingly, on the end of proving out the efficacy of the intervention, you do want to be interested in gauging whether there is uptake of the preventive services. And back to what Judy said earlier, you may see amplification of costs based on people who have not historically had the access and the benefit of prevention. particularly around management of chronic conditions. So not only are the sort of process measures of people approaching and being served by preventive, not only medical care, but behavioral health care, but indicators we can look at in HEDIS and other measures around the utilization of health care in support of conditions like diabetes, which often co-occur with behavioral health conditions. And we found in our target population identified through data match are ubiquitous. Another area that I just wanted to touch on before segueing over to Judy for her thoughts is something that I hold very dear and really wish was more often considered co-equally situated to the savings figures, to the impact from the standpoint of finances and housing stability and the reduction of acute costs, and that is a formal means of evaluating care experience and also life satisfaction. Briefly, we use a very, very high incidence of CAP surveys for that purpose. We also use a life satisfaction scale we have for many, many years with our Money Follows the Person initiative, really to gauge are people by their own report better off in destabilized housing. And I think marrying up these different indicators really presents a very extensive worldview of the improvements you can achieve. Judy, how do you respond to some of that and how you're applying it in Hawaii?
Thanks, Kate. I really wholeheartedly agree with everything that you outlined and also that Melanie covered. I have to say that we are at an earlier phase, and so we don't have, you know, already the beginning of a bunch of data. We do have some early indicators, and I think that's the other aspect of it as well. While we can focus on outcome measures, I think it's also important to be tracking those more interim process metrics so that you can do some rapid cycle improvements as you're moving along. Some of the other aspects that I think are related to that concept of care experience is also even measuring things like engagement, person engagement. A lot of times it takes quite a bit of work before you can even start on this you know concept of getting somebody housed. You're just simply trying to build up trust with those individuals as they're living on the streets, et cetera. And it's important to be tracking that to see how long does it take to engage with individuals. Are you being successful in those efforts? Do you need to think about doing them differently with different folks? I think the other kind of metrics, the interim metrics that we have found are also important to be able to also tell the story of the success, have to do with how long people are housed once they get the housing. So how long does it take to get engaged? How long does it take to have them to find housing? How much housing is there? What's the how long are people able to retain their housing once they achieve it? For Medicaid agencies, these are not the kind of metrics that we normally look at, but they are very essential in working on this kind of a project. I think that, and again, circling back to the behavioral health areas, there's the, you know, are people engaged with their mental health professionals or their substance use professionals, or is often the case the dual diagnosis. A lot of folks, at least in Hawaii, those with the most complex health needs are also suffering from wounds, and that takes a very specialized health care treatment system to be able to provide those services as well. So focusing on how long people have to stay or how they're able to address their wound care or their infections is also important. I don't want to take up too much more time. I did want to just note that on the data sources, it is important to get those data sharing agreements. It's also important to recognize that the data quality of those resources might be not quite what you were expecting, either on the health side, on the, with the claims data that we have access to, marrying that up with the homeless management information system. They might have the data in different kinds of ways and might have gaps in the data, et cetera. So it's, there's a data, in order to get to these metrics, figuring out the data sources, the data quality, et cetera, can also be challenging. And not that you shouldn't do it, but of course you should do it, but it just be aware that that's another issue that you have to think through and work through. Working with behavioral health partners, as was mentioned quite a bit earlier, figuring out the limitations and how it is that you can share data around substance use is always tricky in figuring that out. I know that it's taken quite a bit of work on our part to be able to work that through. And that's even with really strong relationships, et cetera. It still just takes a lot of time and a lot of work to figure all that out. I think the only other thing that I just wanted to make sure that was talked about is that I know that we've been talking a lot about cost savings, and then it just gets a little bit to Kate, what you were covering on the braiding. And it's that's a recognition that in some programs you're actually going to see an increase in investment and an increase in cost, et cetera, and then but the savings might accrue to a different program. And I think knowing that and paying attention to that is going to be important for state agencies. And then also understanding that that some of the things that you're going to be, that some of the goals that you're trying to accomplish, they may not result in cost savings, but from a policy perspective, they're accomplishing these other larger goals. And so being able to state that and being able to tie that then to the outcomes that you're trying to accomplish is also going to be a very, very important thing to be able to measure and to state and to evaluate and put forward. And if you have increased costs, that's okay as long as it was part of the recognition from the outset that may happen. And then also for all those budget people out there, being able to talk about the differences between cost savings and cost avoidance is always important. So I think that's it that I would want to add in to build on what Kate and the other teams had already covered. So Melanie, I think I turn this back over to you for questions.
Great. Thank you, Melanie, Kate, and Judy. And we have lots of questions, more than I think that we'll be able to get through in the time that we have allotted for questions, but we will be making our contact information available for you. I think it's still the final slide. So those questions that we're not able to answer today due to time or that require additional follow-up, we will be providing our contact information. And I'm going to try to combine some of the questions that I think are related. But let me just start off with a few logistical questions that sort of keep coming up. We are going to make the slides available. They are typically posted on Medicaid.gov on the IEP page within about 2 weeks of the webinar. Lots of folks have asked about citations or references, and I think, Melanie, they're asking specifically about the statistics that are referenced regarding Massachusetts and I think Connecticut. And again, I think the best way to do that is to have them reach out directly for that information. But does that work for you, Melanie, or would you like to do that differently?
No, sure. They're welcome to do that, and we can add those citations for those two studies, the Massachusetts and the Connecticut. We can add that to the slides of the information that's posted as well.
Great. There was also a question someone asked. I think either Kate or Judy referenced MFP, which is the Money Follows the Person program, and I can say a little bit about what that is. Money Follows the Person is a CMS-administered demonstration grant program, and the primary purpose of that program is to help states transition individuals who are in nursing homes into community living settings. I think to date they've worked with approximately 44 of the 50 states, so it's a very widely used program throughout the country, and if you're looking for more information about Money Follows the Person, that would be available on Medicaid.gov. There was also a question raised about, and I think this was a reference to IEP, someone asked, how can we find out what our states have done? And really, the best place to start, obviously, I think, is the state Medicaid agency. If you're having difficulty sort of identifying a point person, specifically for our 16 states that have participated in cohort 1 and 2, if you go to the Medicaid.gov IEP site, we have fact sheets on this page which identify points of contact for our state Medicaid housing agency partnerships work. If you have any difficulty finding that, again, you can reach out to Melanie Starnes or myself, Melanie Brown, and our contact information will be available on the last slide.
And I just posted to the chat box the web address for the IEP page for this track, and that the fact sheets that Melanie just mentioned are on there.
So let's turn to some of the questions for our panelists. And I think there were quite a few questions about data collection. Let's start here. So actually, let's start with this one, which is for both Connecticut and Hawaii. It says, in Connecticut and Hawaii's examples, what has the state housing agency's role been in data collection?
Judy, would you like to go first?
Sure. Keeping in mind that we just started to launch. It actually took us quite a bit of time to get our program approved with the appropriate Medicaid authorities. It took a bit longer than we had anticipated. So we just officially launched our program starting in January. But up to that point, we had been working with a public housing agency. They've been helpful in providing information about the numbers of people who were on the wait list, the numbers of people who sort of like the throughput, how many people are housed on a regular basis. We've not figured out yet if and how we would be able to do any kind of a matching. Rather, Hawaii is in the process of working on an agreement with the folks who run our homeless management information system as a starting point. So our public housing agency has been a great partner. But we've not figured out the data sharing aspects of it as far as, like, here's a list of people. The one exception is that we have been working with them with information that is publicly available. If there are individuals who are at risk of eviction, we are seeing if any of those individuals might qualify. But that's, again, that's at the earlier stage. Kate?
So in Connecticut, the Medicaid agency is part of a larger omnibus human services agency. We do also have a standalone Department of Housing, and they and our sister Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services are jointly responsible for creation and oversight of our state-funded supportive housing portfolio. So both of those agencies have been very active work group members with us in Medicaid in developing our intervention. They inventory and make the case from a budget standpoint for the housing vouchers of various types that are an essential part of the intervention itself.
We also have involved in our work group our Housing Finance Authority, really cognizant of the fact that they really have the complementary strand of the tax credits, the direct intervention with developers, many of which are looking for solutions on-site, residential supports for tenants when they're looking to meet criteria associated with public financing for development. So all those pieces, I think, have been really important, and we're pretty purposeful about that. The data from the standpoint of the HMIS is owned and managed by a nonprofit organization, the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. They're the steward of that data, and so it's with that entity that our department has a DUA and, you know, handled the data matching piece.
Great. Thank you, Kate and Judy. So here's another question that is for both of you. Were the Hawaii and Connecticut programs statewide, or were certain areas targeted?
In Hawaii, it's been a statewide effort.
For us also, but I'll say that due to needing to start somewhere with from the standpoint of budget, we did a comprehensive data match that was very, very broad from the standpoint of touch on the homeless system, really any incidence of homelessness. We didn't circumscribe that. And then we used the results of that match to tailor a proposed target population. So we had a larger cohort, and we selected from that about 850 people who had the highest level of need from presenting co-occurring conditions and also costs already within Medicaid, predominantly related to ED hospital admission and SNF use, skilled nursing facility use. And that's where we will place our emphasis and then hopefully build out from there over time. So it is statewide, but it has got a focus, and we're using a Medicaid state plan authority that enables us to target on the basis of those characteristics that I described.
Thank you. And so the next question is asking about the amount of time that it takes to, and they're using cooperative agreement, but I think this is really referencing data use agreements as well as MOUs. It says, how long did it take to get cooperation agreements with law enforcement and homeless providers organizations for data sharing? And were there any substance use disorder data sharing issues that arose?
Well, for us in Connecticut, we were actually approached by the Coalition on Homelessness. They're the steward of that data. They were the ones that were the impetus originally for matches that supported the pilot projects I described earlier. So we were very fortunate to have a not only collegial, but really that type of catalyst to move forward with it. They have in place, which might be of interest to people who are newer to this work, a very effective release form that they ask individuals to sign as they are served through the coordinated access networks of our homeless intervention system. And we were able to utilize those individual releases to frame the use of the data. Now, you can certainly do this on a de-identified basis, and that would have been feasible also for us in Medicaid. But I think you're going to get the greatest impact, obviously, if you can really specifically identify people. The sensitive data is absolutely still constrained by both federal and often state limitations related to privacy, and we really had to predominantly rely on those releases for that purpose. But that is something that we're happy to share our DUA documents. We're happy to offer any kind of practical insight we have from our experience. It was not a small thing, and I think you should plan quite an intensive effort around that in most states.
Thanks, Kate. Is there anything you wanted to add to that, Judy?
No, but I think she did a great job.
Great. Thank you. So, Melanie, there's actually a question here, which is addressed for you. It's asking, it says that Melanie mentioned that self-sufficiency outcomes were observed to be improved. Which exact self-sufficiency measures improved, and how was this measured?
I don't think we talked about self-sufficiency, so I'm not sure what specific thing that person was referring to.
Okay. So if you want, the person who posed that question, if you want to revise your question or add any clarification in the chat box, we'll try to get to it later. And so, Kate, there were a couple of questions that were specifically regarding Connecticut. And one mentioned, it says, can Kate expound a bit on how the CAP survey was modified for your needs?
That's a great question. We have not modified CAPS particular for this particular use. I am interested in that question, and I think that probably deserves more discussion. We have used the person-centered medical home CAPS very widely, and that is something we have regarded as important as we want to have a nexus to more use of preventive care. But I'd actually like to think about that question, and that may be important for us to all of us to think about how that could be framed in a way that better gets at the access and respect type of provisions that CAPS is intended to illustrate.
Okay, great. Thank you. There was also a question, I think this is also specifically referencing Connecticut, Kate. What kind of study, pre-post match comparison or RCT, was conducted for the outcomes? That actually might be a Melanie question, we'll see. For the outcomes you presented for Connecticut of reduced hospitalizations and ED visits.
Yeah, that was the Corporation for Supportive Housing, operating under Social Innovation Funds, had worked with us on a data match, and the CSH did design pre- and post-comparisons. It was very rigorous. They worked with a researcher in an academic institution and really identified, in particular, through use of Medicaid claims data, the impact on incidence of and also cost associated with some of those features of acute care, but also, like I said, the uptake and use of preventive services. And we were really able to help them with that because we have a fully statewide set of Medicaid claims data in Connecticut because we're self-insured. So that was something that we could facilitate for them.
Great. Thank you. So there's a question about return on investment analytics for the IAP program and whether or not we've looked at the possible benefits to the financial performance of affordable housing. So there is actually a national evaluation of IAP as a whole, so the entire technical support initiative, not just our focus areas. But that focus has largely been the focus of that evaluation has largely been around sort of how states are using the technical support and sort of short-term outcomes. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we've looked at a sort of impact or return on investment, but hopefully we will get there in a future evaluation contract. But the existing evaluation is really focused on process and short-term outcomes. And so there's a question about participating states measuring housing stability via HMIS data. Any of our panelists want to speak to that?
I know that's our goal, but we're still at the early stages. Perhaps Kate has something on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we absolutely will want to examine incidence of homelessness for the individuals served. We will continue to refresh the data match, and that is able to yield identified data. And if we see
that phenomena occurring where there's, migration on and off stable housing, and the intervention has not been effective in intercepting that. Obviously, that's going to be something we need to really pay attention to. But I think our plan is predominantly around designing the intervention so that it is comprehensive and fluid enough so that as people's needs wax and wane based on their circumstances, it can be attentive. Like if there's more intensity needed at one point, it can be calibrated to that. And then looking at, like I said, refreshing the data match to see what occurs.
Thank you. And so there's a general question about your state's use of Section 811 Project Rental Assistance Vouchers. Kate or Judy, did you want to speak to your state's use of those resources?
Is there a more specific question about our use
Yeah, I think the question is just, right now it just says, did you use Section 11, 811 vouchers?
Yes, the answer in Connecticut is yes.
Okay.
Yes, they are also being used in Hawaii as well.
Okay, great. If there's a follow-up question, we'll try to get to it. Please enter in the chat box and we'll try to get to it. So this is a question for both, I think, Hawaii and Connecticut. How are agencies handling the data once it's been analyzed? In Montana, the state Medicaid program will be doing the analysis of the data from all organizations, but we're trying to figure out how we can create a data sharing agreement between so many organizations in a timely manner to see how we can share the identified data back to the organizations. How would you guys handle a situation like this?
Yeah, this is Kate again. I mean, this is exactly where you get down to brass tacks with this, how challenging this is. I guess I can say, I think it's useful to, as much as possible, to think about whether you have an existing vehicle for individual releases. Like I said, our Coalition to End Homelessness is using a very, an excellent release form that I think is broad in its conception, also honoring people's privacy, but really allowed us to work within that parameter. And then really, if there's any help that would be gained from it, I would be very happy to share our documents. We just had to kind of buckle through that and also feel satisfied that we were adhering to the federal standards for, in particular for Medicaid, the release being in the interests of members, and then also the protection of the sensitive data. So it's not simple, and I hear you on everything you're asking about. I think it's a matter of kind of looking at what others may have been done and trying to fit it within your setting.
And so there's also a question about whether or not your projects involved Medicaid-managed care, and if so, in what way?
So can you just repeat that? I'm sorry.
Sure. The question is, did these projects involve Medicaid-managed care, and if so, in what way? And I think that these projects is referencing specifically your IEP work.
Yeah. So I'll answer this one because I know that Kate actually does not have Medicaid-managed care in Hawaii. We're all Medicaid-managed care. And how we worked on how we have the Medicaid managed care plans engaged in this project is we have a requirement that each health plan have at least one, what we're calling a housing coordinator. It's someone who can help be that bridge person to the homeless services agencies, to their own case management and care management services, working with the long-term supports and services as they may need to do on the Medicaid, on the health side, and then also working with the housing agencies themselves. So We also looked at the rates, and so we also have for the first time period, given our target population, we're making an assumption that with this work, eventually we will see actually a savings on the healthcare cost side. That being said, that comes with time and also with some initial investment. So we've incorporated that into our rate structures as well. We're in the process of developing some guidance and some guidelines around billing of services and provider enrollment and, you know, how can a homeless services agency become a Medicaid provider, et cetera. So we're still in the process of working through all of that. It's a lot more work than we were anticipating, although by now one would anticipate that we should be expecting that whatever it is that we're doing probably takes twice the time and effort than perhaps what we had thought at the start. So those are some of the various things that we're doing with the Medicaid Managed Care Plan.
Thank you. So there is a question about how your states plan to continue building upon this work. And the question is, what do you see as next in your supportive housing efforts?
Well, in Connecticut, I really see us in an iterative path. We have had the benefit of our experience with our state-funded services, with Money Follows the Person. We were able to translate that into a budget proposal to cover supportive housing services under Medicaid. I really hope we can continue to amplify this work. As I said, we chose a more narrowly defined initial target population. I hope we can build that out to encompass more of the entire set of people who matched. And then also, I think that there's a lot of really important additional features that relate to rebalancing of long-term services and supports, in particular, how we look at repurposing a lot of the institutional settings, such as nursing facilities, that must remain a part of our care continuum, but for which there is less demand over time. So looking at how some of those may be repurposed for other types of housing, including assisted living or shared housing. So that's obviously a certain cohort in the population, people with disabilities and older adults. Looking at how we continue to maximize the use of tax credits for new development, because we're a very costly state for housing. I imagine that's the case for GD also. So how do we reduce the overall costliness of it and do this in a way that helps to support sustainability? So those are some of my thoughts right now. GD, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's hard for us to focus on, hey, what's next, when we're still in the process of trying to build on what we have. I think that our areas are largely, our focus next step areas are, one, I'm trying to, increase and use the housing resources as more efficiently and more effectively. But the other area that has a lot of focus right now is actually on the continuum of care for behavioral health. And this is for both mental health and substance use, and making sure that we have a strong outpatient community in place, that we're able to continue to provide the services so that we are able to address the full continuum. I think because so many of our resources are going towards the acute side and the crisis services, that that building on the from all the way from primary care to those more middle level treatment services are don't get quite as much attention, and so that, I think that is currently what we're sort of a next steps on what we're focusing on in helping to address these issues.
Thank you. So there's a question about which states or communities have been successful in using multiple data sources for supportive housing. And what I'm going to suggest, and then I'll open it up if any of our panelists want to add to that. So there's a number of resources that have come out recently related to permanent supportive housing, measuring, as well as issues related to process. Some of those are available on the ASPE, the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation website. You can also reach out directly to us, and we can share with you where you can find other resources that are related to that. I don't know if Melanie or anyone else on any of our panelists want to talk more specifically about communities or your state's efforts and related to this.
I'm sorry, I was still researching the previous question. And I think we found the self-sufficiency piece. I think it's actually on your slide, Kathy. We can address that. I'm sorry, Melanie, can you say that question again?
So the question was about, we'll come back to the self-sufficiency in just a second. The question was about which states or communities have been successful in using multiple data sources for supportive housing. And I was referencing the number of reports that ASPE as well as others have done related to this issue and saying that we can share that information and just inviting the panelists to share anything in addition to that if you'd like.
Yeah, there's some reports that have been done in the past, I think. The Corporation for Supportive Housing and the Center for Healthcare Services has a number of reports, and they work with a lot of different states. So you can see a number of reports from there would be another good source. And then some of the resources that we'll add when we post the slides will have some additional states. But some states, Kathy, you may be able to speak to this even better about some of the states that have done a lot of work in this area and have used a lot of different data sources. Do you have a good sense of that?
Yeah, I think just, you know, across even just our IAP states, a big piece of the data work is, you know, one, identifying the sources, two, doing the work to put them together based on their needs. So sorry if I'm not nailing this on the head, we'll give it another try. But, you know, obviously the most obvious two are Medicaid and HMIS, the homeless database, but also, you know, recidivism data if you're focusing on the formerly incarcerated population and looking at you know, some of the behavioral health to the degree you can get your hands on that type of data. And so, you know, I think sometimes it can just be simply a match, not simply, but only a match between the two data sources. But a lot of times, especially as states get more and more tailored in terms of what they are trying to look at, they may be, you know, really interested in throwing in some additional data as well.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. Go ahead.
California and New York have done a lot of work in this arena and have looked at a lot of different data sources, so those are a couple of good states, too. California,
yeah, New York. Washington State has a really interesting PRISM, and I always forget what that stands for, but a data that they use was developed in Washington State, and they use that to, you know, match on all types of different markers as well. Always happy. I don't think my email's at the end, but if you have a specific question on that for me, you can just send it to Melanie Starnes, and she'll make sure to get it to me as well.
Your info's there.
Okay.
Well, thank you to all of our panelists. Unfortunately, we are out of time for questions. As I said, we will be providing our contact information at the very end. So if there are additional questions you'd like to send us, please feel free to do so. Also, please make use of our Medicaid.gov IEP webpage. There's many resources that are available throughout the website. So just to recap, some of the key takeaways from today's conversation were that measuring the impact of supportive housing has significant benefits. Measuring outcomes will require compiling data from a variety of sources. Supportive housing can affect more than just healthcare utilization costs. And finally, that measuring outcomes takes time. It's important not to allow perfect to be the enemy of good. So again, I want to thank all of our speakers today, Judy Moore Peterson, Kathy Moses, Melanie Starnes, Kate McAvoy. We thank you for joining us and sharing your expertise and experience with us. And participants, please do reach out to us. The slides will be made available on Medicaid.gov in about 2 weeks. Often it's sooner than that, so please check back. And with that, we're going to close out the webinar. Please take time to complete the evaluation that will follow the presentation. Thank you.